Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast for Friday, April 17th, 2020. On today's episode, we'll hear from Trey and Ashley Lockerby, founders of Better Booch, on The Obstacle is the Way, how setbacks can set you up for success. The Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid, sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid, sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn more about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Now, here's Trey and Ashley with this week's presentation.
We are excited to have Trey and Ashley Lockerby of Better Booch with us today. I'm actually really excited to have them because I have tried their product and I gave it to one of my colleagues and left a note for him that said, you know, this is yummy and the name is funny. And so I was really excited to have, to see that they were on our lineup, our roster for today. And so I want to welcome Trey and Ashley Lockerby. They are going to talk to us about how obstacles can set us up for success, talk about the resilience and persistence that being an entrepreneur takes and how that can create success in us. They are actually a really interesting, couple partnership. They were touring musicians for famous artists, including Rihanna, Lady Antebellum, Selena Gomez, all sorts of things. And then they decided they really wanted to feel connected to a community and a healthier lifestyle. And so they started brewing kombucha in support of one of their family members who had cancer. And now they produce 20,000 gallons a month out of their downtown LA brewery. So with that, I am going to pass it off to Trey and Ashley. I'm going to stop sharing. I'm going to give them the share here and say, welcome. We are so happy to have you with us this morning.
Hi, glad to be here. Happy Friday. Yeah, we've got our coffee. Right. We're ready to meet up virtually. So glad to be here.
Cool. So we'll just hop right in. So when it comes to obstacles, there are those that you can see and prepare for, and then there are the ones that blindside you and you're faced with a decision, fail or move forward. Today, we're going to talk about some of those pivotal moments along our journey.
When we started Better Booch in 2012, 8 years ago, we were brewing 1 gallon at a time in our home kitchen when we first started. Today, 8 years later, we operate out of our 13,000 square foot brewery in downtown Los Angeles and produce about 20,000 gallons of kombucha per month.
But as Christy mentioned, we were not always in the beverage industry. In fact, before we met, we had both been on the road touring both the country and internationally as musicians. After graduating from music school, I toured as a backup singer for Rihanna for 4 years. Oh, there's us. Here's me performing in a blizzard with Jay-Z and Rihanna. That was for a New Year's Eve performance that was pre-recorded. Turns out it was not blizzarding on actual New Year's Eve, so a little inconsistency there. And then the next slide, this is me on the SNL set. And singing with Rihanna during one of the shows, or one of the songs in our live show.
And I spent about 7 years touring the world with artists like Lenka, Lady Antebellum, and Josh Kelly. Here I am performing in China and visiting the Kremlin after a show in Moscow, Russia.
So after so many years of touring, we had both arrived at the same conclusion separately. It just wasn't the lifestyle that we wanted for ourselves long-term. So many late nights, constantly on an airplane, tour bus, or in a venue, and just absolutely no personal time or time to work on, you know, any of our own projects. So when we met, we began brainstorming how to make a life for ourselves at home. And our biggest passion besides music was health and wellness. Trey introduced me to kombucha, and he had started brewing it at home during his sister's battle with breast cancer. Kombucha was well known in the cancer community because of its health properties. So when we started, we started experimenting with different tea blends as a means of achieving great taste without all the added sugar from juices and powders. So when we discovered how much better it could actually be, we wanted as many people to try it as possible.
So Better Booch was born. Here's a photo of our first prototype. We also made some business cards. My title was owner. We were very proud. We even had a launch party with, of course, music.
But, you know, as it turns out, in order to sell your consumable product to the public, you have to make it in a certified commercial kitchen. So we found a shared kitchen that rented by the hour. It was an hour and a half away from our home. And we opted for the least expensive overnight hours, 11 p.m. to 3 a.m., and did all of our brewing and bottling there 4 to 5 nights a week. But we were, some nights we would be bottling right up until we'd have to pack up and head to an early morning farmer's market. But we were so excited to be building something new. I mean, look at how happy we are to be in this kitchen in the middle of the night. We quickly grew out of our timeshare commercial kitchen in about 6 months and started looking for our own space. At this point, we were making around 400 gallons of kombucha per month. The obvious problem in front of us was that we had very little money. But it was a big surprise to us that no one was jumping at the chance to fund a couple of musicians trying to start a beverage company from scratch. So instead, we invested our savings from our days on the road.
We thought we had rented a 1,500 square foot certified commercial kitchen, but the landlord grossly misled us. When we tried to get it permitted in our business's name, we discovered that nothing had been done to code, and we needed to reconstruct the entire facility, plumbing, electrical equipment, and all. This ultimately wiped out all of our expected operating capital, aka our savings. So here I am, breaking ground in the middle of the night when our contractor didn't show up, which was a regular occurrence. Luckily, I had been reading a lot of Stoic philosophy at the time, and the words of Marcus Aurelius repeated in my thoughts over and over: the impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way. This sentiment of the obstacle becoming the way, as the author Ryan Holiday has coined in his eponymous book, has become a theme that has underlined our entrepreneurial journey.
So we crawled across the finish line and made it through permitting on that base, but we were completely out of funds. We had 6 farmers markets a week that we were doing at that time, and we had fought to get places in these markets, and we had no product to sell. We scraped together enough money to place one more order of bottles and tea and supplies, and we commandeered family and friends to join us for a few bottling parties, which were essentially free labor in exchange for the promise of kombucha and good vibes. But we had to get more creative. At one of the farmers markets, we came across a fledgling cold brew coffee company called Secret Squirrel, who needed production space. We subleased half of our space to them to cover our rent and utilities. Little did we know, this was the beginning of a synergistic relationship that lasted over 4 years and a friendship that remains to this day. So this is us at a few events early on. And here's one such bottling party. That's actually Trey's sister, who was one of the main inspirations for starting the company.
And you can see the buckets we originally started brewing in. Not a very sophisticated operation back then. So it's hard to tell from this photo, but this is what our production looked like as we shared our facility with the coffee company. It was a bit cramped. We learned from their mistakes and they learned from ours. They raised outside capital early and went national in accounts like Whole Foods and Target. We continued to bootstrap without funding and grew our sales door by door through independent coffee shops and restaurants. We shared resources, connections, and ideas, We even shared some economies of scale as we sourced the same caps and bottles. Ultimately, we were able to grow our company over 4 years at almost half the cost because we helped subsidize each other's businesses. We never would have survived this long as a company without this relationship.
Yeah, it's so true. Coming up against obstacles squeezes you and forces you to change the way you look at things and the way you get things done. Because of an insecure bias, we never would have chosen to partner with another beverage company so closely because we would have seen them as competition. But this particular obstacle forced a new paradigm of partnership that changed us forever for the better. Another great quote we love that embodies a Stoic sentiment by Benjamin Franklin: when you have a goal, obstacles are actually teaching you how to get what you want, carving you a path.
Secret Squirrel grew with us through the whole 2-year lease at that 1,500 square foot facility. And together we looked for a bigger space. We found a 5,000 square foot facility in downtown Los Angeles that felt massive at the time. And both companies moved in together. We shared the cost of the build out and permitting fees and were able to get it up and running quickly at, again, half the cost for us. This is our new production room and fermentation room at the time. Cut to 2017, we had around 4 people on the brewing and production staff, a single sales manager and 2 sales reps. Aside from Ashley and myself, we were producing about 10,000 gallons per month at that point. Through a contact that Secret Squirrel had, we were able to get in touch with the product development team at one of America's most beloved grocery stores. We pitched them on creating a private label kombucha for them, and they went for it. But the only caveat was they wanted it in a can, and we were producing in bottles.
We did not have a canner at the time. And also keep in mind, no one was putting kombucha in a can in 2017. So we had our doubts, but we took a leap of faith. We found a way to finance a canning machine and larger tanks to accommodate their projected volumes. And now our brewery looks just a little bit nicer.
So this is what our brewery looks like pretty much today. Even though we had a lot of new equipment, the product rollout was a near disaster. It was our first time launching a national product. Everyone on our team pulled several all-nighters and learned how to operate and control the new equipment as fast as humanly possible, while maintaining the same level of quality, and that was key.
So after a few great initial orders with this company, sales of that product dropped off. They ended up doing about half of the anticipated volume. And because of this, they discontinued the product after only 8 months. This was obviously not something anyone had anticipated. Because of the excitement and confidence in the product from everyone on their team, we put all of our eggs in this basket. After a grueling scale-up and months of hustling to get orders out on time, we had about a third of our top-line revenue drop out from under us all at once. Not to mention, we had all this new debt from new equipment that we now couldn't pay off.
After the big private label products fell off the market, we figured we'd sell our canning line, pay off the debt, and write it off as a bad dream. But then we landed a meeting with Whole Foods. We pitched them on our bottles, but we mentioned in passing that we had a canning line, and they got really excited. They said, "Oh, can you make better booch in a can?" To which we replied, "Oh, no. You don't want cans. Our bottles sell very well, and we don't think our customers are ready for a canned kombucha." The buyer sat quietly for a moment and then said, "It's the cans or nothing." So we pushed forward to create and launch our line of kombucha in cans, which debuted at Whole Foods. This is what our product looks like today. You can find it at Whole Foods and many other places. This is our fresh new branding.
Yeah, and luckily, Whole Foods was right about the can. So we quickly grew to become one of their top-selling products, and our cans have become so popular that we are fully focused on cans this year. We saw 200% growth over the last year in our can sales. So we're going to run with that. Whole Foods is expanding us into new regions, and our cans have been authorized at more national retailers like Target and National Grocers. And in the fall, our cans debuted as the number one product in sparkling beverage in our cans debuted as the number one product for sparkling beverage on Amazon in the fall, and we're seeing rapid growth nationwide. So much so that Better Booch was listed on the Inc. 5000 list of fastest growing companies just recently.
So this success that came from an obstacle caught the attention of a massive coffee retailer who then approached us about developing and producing a kombucha for them under their juice banner. At the time, this was the biggest contract we had ever been awarded, and we saw it as our path to early retirement. They laughed in our faces when they came and saw our tiny little operation, but they simply couldn't find a product with the same level of quality anywhere else. This is a photo of that company and us working together in our tiny little office. See how cramped it looks.
I'll say this, scaling is hard. It's supposed to be hard. Because of our previous experience with the other private label products, we thought that we were adequately prepared, but we were wrong. We were so wrong. The projected volumes for this product were 10x the projections of the previous retailer. So we needed funding to upgrade our bottling line, hire a VP of operations, and tighten up ops to achieve the required manufacturing certification. This led us to our $3 million seed round. With a contract like this on the table and massive growth in our own canned kombucha, it was surprisingly easy to find funding.
But even with that money, the product launch was so tumultuous that it put us in what Elon Musk once called production hell. For over a month, I found myself driving a forklift at 3 or 4 a.m., loading trucks full of product after most of the production workers had gone home for the day, all while Ashley was home nursing our newborn baby. We were so relieved when we finally got caught up on the purchase orders and began to see the product on shelves at some of our favorite stores.
And that's when we discovered another obstacle, market timing. Just as we were too early with the cans for our first co-packing venture, we found ourselves too late with this one.
Turns out that even with all the money this big company had behind this new product, it was simply too late to the party. A lot of retailers wouldn't take on a new kombucha. The shelf space was already spoken for, and kombucha consumers had already found their favorite brands and were staying loyal. The product launched in conventional chains like Ralph's and Albertsons, but died on the vine.
Yes, so the volumes ultimately came out to about 25% of what was forecasted. And after 9 months of planning, scaling up, hiring new people, getting new certifications and new equipment and other gargantuan efforts, the parent company made the difficult decision to pull the product off the market only 11 months after launch. By this time, we had been through enough highs and lows to recognize the cyclicality and knew it wouldn't be long before we were back up again. And that's the thing, and maybe some of you can relate. It's not that being an entrepreneur ever gets easier. It's just, you know, as they say, more money, more problems. It's just that we learn so much from each of these challenges that we simply become better at navigating setbacks.
The silver lining of this scenario is that it made us a better company, upgraded on every level. Our operations team are now as fine-tuned as Navy SEAL. So much so that I'm happy to say that we've launched a third private label product recently, and it was a flawless launch. We were able to use the funds we raised during the seed round to invest in our own brand, hiring a VP of sales who built out a sales team, and they've already helped us set up our brand for success in 2020 and 2021, despite the current world climate. We've come to learn a valuable lesson over the years that someone else learned many centuries ago. As the leader of Rome and therefore the world at the time, Marcus Aurelius endured everything from constant war, betrayal, a terrible plague, a depleting treasury, and many more obstacles. Now, everyone's obstacles are unique to them, but it's hard to imagine anyone enduring much more than Marcus, certainly in his position. what set him apart and made him great was his mindset. He understood that setbacks are never permanent, and what impedes you can empower you if you can practice the following virtues: patience, courage, humility, resourcefulness, reason, justice, and creativity.
So that's what we wish for you. We hope that whatever you're going through, whether it's your own entrepreneurial journey or the challenges from the COVID-19 pandemic, that you find peace and patience through it all. We know that anywhere worth going is not easy to get to. Otherwise, everyone would do it. And one more quote for you to ponder by another Stoic, Seneca the Elder: the greatest obstacle to living is expectation, which depends on tomorrow and wastes today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that. I'm very inspired, and I'm excited to hear such a powerful story behind something that I really enjoyed and loved so much. So thank you for sharing that with us today. We do have a few questions from the audience here. And audience, just a reminder, if you have questions, go ahead and put that into the Q&A panel. That's where I'll be taking questions from. So the first question actually was around kind of your first story with the difficulties with the landlord and breaking new ground. Why mm-hmm. didn't the landlord have to pay for that? What happened there?
Yeah, so, well.
When it comes to a commercial lease, and this is some gray area, of course, but with commercial leases, it's not like residential leases where your landlord will come fix your laundry machine or whatever. It's with commercial leases, it's like
usually as is.
Whatever you need for your business, you are responsible for. So the fact that, you know, it was us doing it or us taking him to court, and it just wasn't, you know, worth it in the long run.
No.
Got it. Why did you initially resist the can versus bottle for your brand when you started producing cans?
Well, so I am still very attached to the glass format, and that is the traditional format for kombucha. So I think the resistance was simply that there was no canned product on the market, and you know, our resistance when Whole Foods asked for it was certainly based on the fact that the private label that we had launched prior to that cited the canned format as one of the reasons that it wasn't selling well. So we were just really afraid that if we launched in Whole Foods with our own brand with cans, that that people wouldn't go for it. But turns out that they were right and you're wrong. It's just a timing issue. And I think at the same time, kind of around the same time, a lot of craft beer breweries whose brands were associated with quality and consistency and kind of an elevated experience had started canning their product. And so people were starting to think of cans, you know, in a little bit more of an elevated light rather than something that is traditionally thought of as a little bit lower brow.
Yeah, we actually have the most premium ingredients of any kombucha on the market, and cans weren't always, you know, correlated with premium products, right? So we wanted to make sure that was getting represented. So that led to the rebranding and trying to, you know, show everybody that this was a premium product and cans were the best way to preserve it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Why were the product launch projections so far off? Kind of who made the projections, and what do you think that they could have done better?
Oh man. Well, everyone wants to believe, it's human bias, right? Everyone wants to believe that you have to kind of, if you're an entrepreneur, you have to believe that whatever efforts you're putting forth are going to be successful. Otherwise, why do it? And those volumes were based on the volumes that other kombucha products were doing at the grocery store level. Yeah. So what they didn't factor in is the brand loyalty factor, as well as this. I mean, kombucha is a brew, right? It's not the same as if you also think about it as beer, just because that's an easy comparison. But if you think of like your favorite craft brew, that you buy every time you go to the grocery store. And then what if that grocery store put out their own version of that brew? You might not be inclined to, you know, some people would grab it because maybe it would be a little bit cheaper, but most people would still buy their favorite. And so that's what was happening at grocery store level. It's like these bigger companies that were putting out their own version of kombucha, they just didn't have the trust built in that other major brands had. And I think that was the major, major factor in the disappointing sales.
Okay. Roughly how much of your savings did you put in? Feel free not to answer or to provide a range. Up to you.
It came out, we expected to put in something around $30,000. That was like our starting capital. And the facility ended up costing us like an additional $20,000 on top of that, that we had to, you know, use the remaining balance of our savings for. So we were, totally wiped out.
Ouch. Very impressive. Yeah. Like the number of times you've been able to kind of come past your obstacles is super inspiring. Can we expect any new flavors in the coming months? They're loving the new Ola Horchata.
Yes. In fact, our favorite flavor is about to be released on Amazon in just a few weeks from now. It's called Hibiscus Healer, and it's a hibiscus with blueberry and cranberry. It's a great summer, easy drinker, and very refreshing.
Delicious. Great cocktail mixer, too.
Oh, nice. Any preferred alcohol that mixes with it?
Mezcal, for sure.
Yeah, I like mezcal, but really it's good with anything.
Okay. How long did you spend trying to raise capital, and what was your experience?
Well, we certainly tried raising capital before we successfully did so. I mean, it probably over the course of 7 years, we were always out there looking, you know.
But not super, but not super seriously.
Yeah, we were, there's a great book out there called No Man's Land, and it really helps describe the scenario a lot of entrepreneurs get into, where they're too small to be big and too big to be small. Then you find yourself in this nebulous area where it's hard for people to invest, because either the money, they can't put it in enough to move the needle for them, or it's too much for that your friends and family can't afford. So it took us about 7 years to get to a point where we were, you know, had the best foundation to raise capital. But ultimately we never would have changed the way we've done it, because that bootstrapping taught us how to be frugal, taught us how to be resourceful, mm-hmm.
How to run a profitable business.
It's really invaluable, that experience. Mm-hmm.
But I think talk about like how long it took once we did try to raise money.
Yeah.
How long did it take from making the sale, making the deck, for example, to closing the round?
It typically takes around 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, almost the whole amount of time that we were negotiating the contract with the other retailers.
Exactly.
Okay. Was there a worry with quality of product when mass production came into play?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was quality of product is always the top priority. And, you know, we had these businesses, we had their entire quality team in our facility the entire time, breathing down our necks, you know, making sure everything is made to spec. And which, again, was just such an amazing experience, because it really, you know, it's how we cut our teeth in the quality department and really, you know, progressed and became so advanced.
Yeah, I mean, truly, quality has been the name of the game for us from the very, very beginning. And unlike what a lot of other companies, I think, do, I feel like as we've gotten bigger, we've actually gotten better, because we've been able to invest in people who know a lot more than we do, and better, more sophisticated equipment and testing. And so today our product is more consistent and better than ever.
Great. Did you worry that the private labels would cannibalize your own brand?
Yeah, that was certainly a concern, but the mentality, when we go into co-packing, the idea is that there's some kind of potential monopoly play. so that, for example, in both scenarios, the retailer, could have, if they wanted to, ultimately just had their own brand on the shelf. You know, there's some retailers that that's a model for them, right? Where for certain products, it's only their brand on the shelf. And so we went, you know, it was sort of, if you can't beat them, join them sort of philosophy for the co-packing.
Great. In the parts of your story where the product was pulled off the shelves, did you have a contract for the minimum, which helped you finance expansion and equipment, or was that not in play?
Yeah, so both contracts ended amicably, which was nice. And we definitely found agreements that made sense for both parties. But, you know, being such a small company and taking on such a big contract, you don't have a ton of leverage. So minimums, we did have minimums, but they weren't really enough to keep like a sufficient cash flow for us. So, you know, it wasn't that adequate.
Yeah. And even with the second scenario, we had negotiated, I mean, we spent almost a year, like 9 months, negotiating the contract with them. And the only scenario that no one had provided for was the product not being successful. And in fact, you know, there was an extenuating circumstance with that scenario where the person who had shepherded the product from the retailer side, who became a wonderful friend of ours and kind of like a mentor, actually passed away. So that product, that was just something that obviously no one could control. And so because of that, the new person that they brought in cut the product.
Yeah, that was a big part of it.
Wow, I'm so sorry for your loss. And then to have the second scenario happened on top of that must have been really difficult. Sorry about that. You've had two opportunities with large customers that didn't work out. Kind of what's your takeaway? Would you do that again?
Well, we'll certainly never launch a new product. You know, we've resorted to the idea that if there's an existing product on shelf and we have capacity, we might consider something like that, because co-packing has been a great source of cash flow. It's a great way to retake that money and reinvest it in our own brand and grow our brand the way we want to. But it's certainly a big risk to launch anything new, especially for somebody else. And what we've ultimately learned is that what didn't really work for those retailers is actually what's working for Better Booch, right? Because as Ashley has mentioned earlier, the customers really want an authentic kombucha brand. You know, our customers are very smart and savvy when it comes to health and wellness. And they understand the quality it takes to produce a really good kombucha. And so, you know, it's only made us bigger believers in our own brand, and we are solely focused on our own brand moving forward.
Mm-hmm. How did your investors react when the large beverage company backed out?
Good question. I think we were so panicked, because we don't want to let our investors down. Of course, it's a big, you know, weight to carry. And they were so understanding. We had this big town hall phone call like this, and we informed them of everything that was going on. And everyone was kind of like, well, we invested in you guys. You know, we invested in Better Booch. We love Better Booch. Like, that was just sort of icing on the cake. And that's the message that they gave us. And they were like, you guys will figure it out. We're investing in the people, not the product. So it just like really reassured us that we found the right investors, mm-hmm. you know, who understood what they were getting to and, you know, believe in us.
We also, when we were negotiating the round, we were very conservative about, with our valuation. We didn't want to factor, too much on the co-packing business. It was mostly based on, the potential that the Better Booch brand had.
It was very fair. Yeah.
What are some of the pros and cons of having a business with your spouse / partner?
Well, goodness. I mean, it's funny. Mm-hmm. Ashley and I, you know, before we had this business together, we had a band together. I mean, we're just like, you know,
we like doing stuff together.
Yeah. it's really, you know, if we weren't doing this, it still would feel like we were, because we share each other's, you know, we share ideas and we talk about, we love strategizing and, solving puzzles together. And so it's not much different. It's hard to imagine, you know, what it would look like if we weren't in business together.
I mean, that being said, what we have learned over the last 8 years of having this business together is that it works so much better when we have clearly defined roles and clearly defined responsibilities. So if we're both, you know, I think early on, we kind of got into this thing where we were both trying to play whack-a-mole and like keep it all together. And there was a lot of overlap and a lot of like, I thought you were handling this and I thought you were handling this. And,
right.
you know, so once we, just like, you know, any other company would organize and have specific, job descriptions, having that was a huge, huge improvement in all areas. And then the other thing is, setting a time and being really diligent about when you turn it off.
Yeah.
Because it is easy when you are partnered with your spouse to talk about business all day and all night. And that's not great for romance. So you got to turn it off at some point.
Yeah. You got to have boundaries all the time. That's yeah. for sure.
Do you two miss your old life? Kind of the music part, or is that still incorporated?
Surprisingly, I don't. I think it's a young man's game, or young woman's game. I think it's like, you know, I'm so thankful.
I mean, I'm still a young woman, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Of course. But, you know, it's something that was great when we were in our early 20s, and I wouldn't change it, but it's not a lifestyle I want for myself now, especially having a kid. But,
the only thing I miss about it is the total lack of responsibility. I mean, you just wake up and someone tells you where to be every single day.
Ashley didn't even have to carry an instrument around. She just used her voice. So she just showed up to work, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty easy. But yeah, in all seriousness, definitely don't miss it. I think what being an entrepreneur and having this business has taught me is that you know, before we started this business, I had never considered any other option for myself other than being a musician. I was involved in music from the time I could speak, basically, and went to music school. I mean, never considered any other option. I was totally convinced that was going to be my life. And, you know, when we went on the road and I actually saw what it would mean to reach that level of success in the music industry, I realized that it just was not for me. And so being an entrepreneur just, I feel like, opened my mind to so many other possibilities. And I'm sure that, you know, we talk about it all the time, what we might get into next. And, you know, I don't think those ever would have been even possibilities in my mind if we hadn't started this business.
Yeah. And one of the biggest, you know, learnings I had through this experience was how creative business is, right? We always thought music was like this creative, that's the creative industry. But man, business is just as creative, if not more so, and so much more complex and interesting in some ways. And, you know, sharing our tea with people is the same as sharing a song with somebody, really. That's the same validation and the same experience of building a community. And so it's kind of just swapped with, you know, for one thing to another.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you guys remember your elevator pitch? Can you share it with us?
Our elevator pitch. Yeah. Well, like our old elevator pitch or our current elevator pitch?
Yeah, you're like your, well, both. Both is great.
Well, okay. So our elevator pitch is, we are, Better Booch is a premium small craft kombucha company. We believe that the healthiest choice should be the obvious one. And we do that through a brew that is meticulously tested for quality and tastes as great as it makes you feel.
Love it. Love it. Are you guys in Trader Joe's?
We're not in Trader Joe's yet, but we are talking to them and hopefully launching with them fairly soon, hopefully maybe later this year.
What was the point you decided you needed to make your first hire, and what was that position for?
So our first hire was actually someone who could handle brewing. And this is, you know, for a long time we had one employee and that person actually did the brewing while we were out there trying to sell ourselves into stores and delivering product out of our red minivan for a year or two, you know, all over town as a delivery driver. So that was employee number one, just someone who could handle the production. And then, you know, that got us so far. And we realized at some point that we needed someone who really knew how to scale this product. So the next employee we hired was an actual brewmaster with a degree in chemistry and a degree from Siebel. And that was kind of a huge inflection point for our company.
And as you grew, kind of how did you go about contacting like better and better people to enhance your product?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that because we were bootstrapping and we were trying to run a profitable operation, or we had to run a profitable operation, we only made moves like that when it was absolutely necessary. So when we found our brewmaster, that was like such great luck. I think we put an ad out on like those like resume websites, and we interviewed a ton of people, and we found this guy, and he actually didn't live in California, so he moved down for the job, and so that was great. And then past that, we have used recruiters, and when we've needed to hire for a very specialized position, and we've also found people through our current employees.
Yeah, I heard Tony Robbins describe this path for entrepreneurs where you hire your friends and family, right? But at first, which is what we did, and you know, because you can afford them, but they don't have, you know, lasting power. And then you hire inexperienced people for a little, because you can afford them, but you're only going to get so far. And then after a certain time, you start understanding the value of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And even though you're paying up for it, you know, we've made a few hires in the last year that have, you know, there's the saying, good people pay for themselves as well. And we're at the point in our stage of this career where we understand how experience can be impactful, and we've hired up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, every time you do that, it's scary because you're like, oh my gosh, I'm paying this person more than I'm paying myself, you know? But like Trey said, good people absolutely pay for themselves. So if you can have, you know, a pretty rigorous vetting process, definitely call references, you're going to be in good shape.
Great. Those are great tips. Do you guys work with a microbiologist or with chemistry for new flavors and better concepts?
Yes, we do. So our quality manager is a microbiologist, and our master brewer is a chemist, and our head brewer is a chef. So between the three of them, we bring a lot of science to the equation. It's one of the ways we were able to develop an authentic kombucha that's also non-alcoholic. So we have a proprietary process for our brewing that's all, you know, based on the organisms that are inside of it. And so, it's something we've invested a lot in over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a number of references for inspiration, Marcus Aurelius, Ben Franklin. Did you have other key sources of inspiration and encouragement through this process?
Yeah, I actually found that reading business books, you know, all the obvious ones, but you know, Tim, I like to joke that what really gave us the kick in the ass to start the company was reading Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. And I read that book in 2011 and was like, oh, business is so easy. You know, I can work 4 hours a week. And we ultimately set out and did the exact opposite of everything in that book. I mean, that book's all about outsourcing everything. And we did a handcrafted, locally sourced product that we sold locally. I mean, it was just, we did the exact opposite. But I found that by reading those experiences in those books, you know that you're not alone, right?
Mm-hmm.
You start to relate and say, oh, okay, people have been here and done this before. And the emotional swings get, you know, less and less over time.
Yeah, I think that I found so much inspiration just from the community of entrepreneurs that I've met over the years. And that's why things like this are so important, because like Trey said, it can feel so isolating to be working on something and coming up against these obstacles and feeling like you're doing something wrong. But when you hear stories from other people who are like, no, no, it's just that hard, you know, it kind of emboldens you, and it's very inspiring. And also you find creative ways to partner with some of these people that maybe you wouldn't have thought of before if you'd never tried.
I would also say that music is probably the most difficult career. I mean, it is all about persistence. So I don't think that part, you know, I think we, you know, develop that skill or mindset, you know, over the course of our music career, because, you know, that's a very hard career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The resilience, the persistence. Speaking of resilience and persistence, how is COVID-19 affecting your business?
Oh man. Well, it changes seemingly daily, as I'm sure it has, for everyone. We're a business that supplies essential businesses, so we have been permitted to stay open, but we are taking every precaution. We've scaled back our production in a huge way. We're producing with as few people in the space as possible, and we've upped our, you know, sanitation practices and all of that. But at the same time, demand has obviously dropped at grocery store level. We did see a huge spike, and now it's like foot traffic in all the grocery stores has really dropped off. But what has started to soar is our online sales. So thank God we were set up on Amazon, because now people can, we're seeing sales just go gangbusters online. And we actually just yesterday launched our own e-commerce store at betterbridge.com. So you can get it through our directly.
Yeah, it's delivered right to your door, ice cold. So it's ready to drink.
Fantastic. So I think you need to repeat that part. Remind them where it is again. Say that one time,
so,
just in case people got distracted for a second.
Yeah, so betterbridge.com. You can click on our shop and you can purchase Betterbridge by the case, delivered cold right to your door in as little as 5 days, sometimes as early, as little as overnight if you're in the right place. And we're just leaning into our online sales right now because that is what is really flourishing. So, we have seen wholesale drop off a bit, online sales are growing. And so we're just leaning in.
It seemed that Secret School played an important role in the beginning. Has their journey and path been similar to yours?
Yeah, they actually, you know, they did very, almost opposite to us in those early days. They ultimately sold their company and exited, and they've continued to grow from there. So once they exited, they moved out of our facility, but the owner and we've all kept in touch and still share resources and contacts wherever we can and bounce ideas off of each other. But yeah, they've since, even the founders that we know of have now moved on to their next project.
Okay. Is there reasoning behind not producing the alcoholic version, or will you produce an alcoholic version in the future? Is it something you're considering?
So we have a lot of innovation, I'll say. We're not necessarily sure it'll be a hard kombucha yet. You know, I will say that it's a lot harder to make a non-alcoholic kombucha than it is to make an alcoholic kombucha. And we've mastered the non-alcoholic process. And we're big on health and wellness. And obviously, we like to imbibe occasionally, just like the next person. So nothing against that. It's just that our focus is really on low sugar, low calorie, non-alcoholic products that are good for you.
Yeah, it doesn't really align. An alcoholic product, an alcoholic kombucha under the Betterbridge banner doesn't really align with our mission as a company. We're about food as medicine, and we support non-toxic cancer research through City of Hope, and just doesn't really align with our mission. So for now, we're not doing it.
Got it.
We recommend Betterbridge cocktails at home.
A Betterbridge cocktail, yes. Mix your own. It's there for you to create your own cocktail. All your creativity can come out.
That's for you.
Exactly. this question is around, you know, kombucha is somewhat of a new, it's old, but it's new. And it didn't exist in the markets a while back. Do you think it's on a trajectory that it will fade out? Are you looking at other products as well, looking at that life cycle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so creativity is a core value at Better Booch, and our brewing team, I mean, they're coming up with new innovations weekly. So we have a large, long pipeline of, innovation that we'd love to bring to market at some point. But, right now our focus is on our own brand and our own product. And kombucha, we believe, is seeing rapid growth. It even did grow last year, just not as much as the year before. But as we enter this new era where people are going to be more health conscious than ever and trying to boost their immunity, we believe kombucha is the perfect product for them. And we believe that, more adoption is underway.
And truly, kombucha has seen, hockey stick growth in the natural channel. And we feel that what's next for kombucha is to capture a lot of new kombucha drinkers through the conventional channel as kombucha becomes a more widely known product and certainly as America and the U.S. as a whole kind of all move towards better for you, a little more conscious about what they're consuming products. So I think whereas the kombucha industry has seen previous growth in the natural channel, I think what's next is conventional. So that's where we're headed.
And for you guys, what are your future plans? Is it a lifestyle company? Do you just want to get bigger and bigger? Do you want to get acquired, go public? So many options.
Yeah, I'd say that, at this point, it's exceeded all of our expectations, right? We set out to sell at farmers markets, originally. So we've outgrown like any expectations we'd set for ourselves. And so now we feel like we're playing with house money a little bit, and we just want to see how far we can take it. So our mission right now is to bring Better Booch to as many people across the country as we can.
Great. Have these questions brought up anything else for you that you want to add or let us know about?
No, I'm just grateful for the opportunity to share our experience and our journey, and hopefully it's encouraging and enlightening. I mean, certainly the persistence is king. So.
Yeah, these are all really great questions.
Yeah, really great questions.
So have really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, it's been a great conversation. Thank you, all of our attendees, for great questions. I think, Stephen, I put it in the answer column around where to get your Better Booch, and you can order it directly and check them out. We are really grateful to have Trey and Ashley. I'm feeling very inspired. So I'm glad that my drink that was delicious and funny can now be an inspiration. So I'm very grateful for that as well. Next week, we are looking forward to one of my favorite speakers, actually, Valerie Alexander. She's on here with us today. I saw her ask a few questions. She is fantastic. She's going to talk about how to maximize happiness and engagement when leading remote teams. So be sure and join us next week for that. With that, I want to say thank you all for joining. Thank you again to Trey and Ashley. We wish you all the best in your ventures and adventures and with your family. So everybody, stay safe and well. Take good care and have a great weekend.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com, and get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.